Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. So glad to have you tuned in today. Really looking forward to sharing our conversation in the hour ahead. I'm Neil Stavem, Ted Ross here. And Ted, I don't know, do you consider yourself a creative person? Are you an artist?
Yeah, well, I majored in theater in college, so have that bend, I guess, a bit. Yeah.
We're going to talk artistry today, and which is maybe not always easy to do on air.
Yeah, it's
really
visual.
We're not really going to describe pictures, but we are going to talk about creativity and, you know, in fact, the beauty. Do we need beauty in our lives? You know, there are limited resources. How do we cultivate and care for our souls in a larger culture? Our guest today is going to talk about culture care versus culture wars.
A really important topic, I think. I mean, I think about my own kids. You know, they're very little. They like to draw. They like to paint. But now that they've gotten older, they've kind of gotten away from that. And I think as an adult, I've kind of gotten away from looking and noticing more art and things like that. But once I take the time to look at it, it can be inspiring and impressive.
Now, our guest is going to talk about that, in fact, how we encourage creativity in our children and in our lives as well. One of the benefits of being on the University of Northwestern campus is that we have great guests that come by to talk with students, and that's what happened in this case. I had a chance to talk to Makoto Fujimura a few days ago, and I'm looking forward to sharing the interview with you in the next couple minutes. Plus, we have some copies of his book to give away, and we'll talk about that just ahead. Makoto Fujimura is an artist, a former presidential appointee to the National Council of Arts, and a founder of the International Arts Movement and the Fujimura Institute. He was recently appointed director of Fuller Seminary's Brehm Center, and he has done some amazing works, and I could spend quite a bit of time just reading his bio, but I think we're just going to jump right in and get to meet our guest today. He has a new book just coming out called Silence and Beauty, Hidden Faith, Born of Suffering. We'll talk about that in a bit. But one of his books is called On Becoming Generative, An Introduction to Culture Care. And the question is, I guess, do we need more beauty in our lives or need beauty in our lives in general? And I'm interested, I guess, maybe, Mako, before we start, say a word about how you define art, I guess. That's what you are. You're an artist, but right. How do we really define that?
Well, artists, those creatures that hates definitions. So we walk around every day trying to avoid categories and being very difficult to people who
need categories.
Yeah. And but at the same time, you know, I always think a true artist, ones, poets, theater artists, actors, filmmakers, poets, who visual artists who do what they do despite the fact that no one really cares about what they're doing, and they do it despite that they have this particular makeup that drives them to deeply into issues that concern them, and they won't let go until it is released into the world in some form. They are highly sensitive creatures who want to ask deeper questions that it may make other people uncomfortable. But there are also people who provide this extraordinary level of craftsmanship and beauty into the world. And oftentimes in our world, that is dismissed as something peripheral or extra, something that's nice to have if you have extra resources or space on your walls, but it's not necessary. And artists are those people who feel that it's necessary.
You know, you mentioned asking deeper questions. So does art affirm culture, or does it sort of arrest it or oppose it?
Well, art is part of culture. We are part of culture. There is no we versus them in culture. So everything that we make becomes part of culture at large, although we tend to be consumers of culture rather than makers of culture. And that has tainted or twisted our making abilities into really being satisfied with idols of somebody else's creation. So it's really important for us and our children to learn to create and imagine the world and to know that, you know, we are the only creatures in the universe, as far as we know, that has been given this capacity by God to imagine the future and to see that the imagination be actualized in the world. And that's an enormous power that we don't do well to harness, especially as in our education system. We tend to do the opposite of creating specific categories for people to, you know, have to check into, and we don't assume that every single person has a different journey.
I know you describe yourself wary of putting adjective before artist. So are you a Christian artist or an artist who's a Christian?
Right. And I always say the word Christian should not be used as an adjective. I say it should be a noun. I'm a follower of Christ. That is the most important aspect of me. And therefore, I am an artist who is a follower of Christ, and I am a Christian first and most, and that should be the central identity, central noun of my life, and Christ is that. I think art, though, has this particular exceptionalism in that Christ himself is an artist, God is an artist, so God is the artist, so we worship this artist. So what does it mean then for us as creatures of his creation who's been invited into this journey of creativity and imagination, who's been invited into co-creation of being heirs of his throne as princes and princesses of his kingdom, to create into this new world that God is creating. And he's somehow, miraculously and amazingly, has invited us into that.
I know you and your family moved to the U.S. when you were 13. I don't know if you were a Christ follower at that time, but I'm wondering how your artistry, your work is different now than maybe before you were a Christ follower. I mean, were you interested in art before you were interested in faith?
Yeah, I was always an artist. I was actually born in Boston.
Okay.
And my father is a scientist, and he was doing his research in Boston. And I was born in Boston, went to Sweden for 2 years, and went to grade school in Japan. And so coming back to U.S., I struggled with the culture and language because I didn't really fit. And I actually don't fit into Japan either. So I've always grown up in this feeling of exile. But I always knew that I was an artist. I didn't know if that was a particular job that you can have or make a full-time living at it. I just knew that whenever I made things, that something will go through me, that and I knew that it wasn't mine. I knew very early on that there was this mark on me that allowed me to capture something in the world that not many people around me saw. And I had this particular ability to express, both with images and words, actually, that allowed me to capture that. And it wasn't until when I was 27 that I finally knew the name of the one that called me to do that, and was, you know, that it was the Holy Spirit flowing through me, even though I was not aware of Christ's presence in my life. And when I became a follower of Christ, it finally made sense that there was this God of the Bible who created and who made the universe rather gratuitously. He didn't do it out of need. He did it out of love. And that made total sense to me because I knew that there was something more than utility and efficiency and just the mechanics of creating something useful, that art does these extravagant things that we don't really have categories for. So I when I came to Christ, I understood Christ speaking this mysterious language of parables and speaking in terms that would typically be dismissed. You know, he said, do not worry about what you eat or what you wear, but consider the lilies.
Yeah.
What does that mean? You know, like, what is he saying that, you know, walking around and looking at flowers? Is that somehow going to allay, you know, that to get rid of our fears? And biblical message works like that. It's oftentimes it works against what we know to be our own security and our own understanding of knowledge.
It's interesting, though, that even as you experienced your creative, because you know the creator of the universe had just instilled that within you. I mean, his creativity just flows through so many things, right? I mean, great art is great art, right? Mm-hmm. And God, whether it's done in, for His glory, He gets glory from it, doesn't He?
That's correct. And whether we are actually conscious of the source of this creativity or not, every time we create, we are exercising that marker of the maker, and we are created to be creative, so we cannot help but to. Now we can twist that in the innate ability into creating something that would destroy the world. We can twist it to make an idol for ourselves. We can twist it just toward purity, self-expression, and ego, and narcissism. But ultimately, God is glorified through all of our acts, and that's the power and mystery of creation.
Talking with Meiko Fujimura, who was recently appointed director of Fuller Seminary's Brehm Center, is an artist, a writer, a speaker who is recognized worldwide as a cultural shaper, and he was a presidential appointee to the National Council on the Arts, served as an international advocate for the arts, speaking with decision makers and advising governmental policies on the arts. We're talking about it today, and talking about some of his artwork, his creations, his writing, and we're going to continue our conversation. We'll get some perspective. What is beauty? Is beauty only in the eye of the beholder? And talk a little bit about the church. You know, what are the arts for, and how can the church perhaps embrace it more fully? All that and more coming up in a moment here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we are honored today to have in studio Meiko Fujimura, who is, among other things, most notably, I guess, an artist. He's a former presidential appointee to the National Council on the Arts, founder of the International Arts Movement and the Fujimura Institute, director of Fuller Seminary's Brehm Center. He's written several works, and a new one that's just coming out. We're going to talk about Silence and Beauty, Hidden Faith Born of Suffering. But, Meiko, you address beauty. Help us understand. Even, I think, you know, we wonder, I guess, maybe about modern art particularly. Is beauty only in the eye of the beholder? Is there a workable definition?
Well, in contemporary times, beauty has been exiled. Mm-hmm. And even the conversation about beauty has become suspect in itself. It's certainly a contested word in modern culture. Beauty seems to be, to a lot of people, very superficial, cosmetic beauty, so that's understandable. But the way I've understood beauty from my childhood years growing up in Kamakura, Japan, which is the 13th century capital of Japan, beautiful city by the ocean. And beauty in Japan is always connected with sacrifice. So every time we sit down to eat a beautiful meal, something is being sacrificed. Sunset is, you know, sun dying. Mm-hmm. Cherry blossoms falling is the most beautiful ephemeral reality, because it is going away. And so that understanding of beauty with sacrifice is something that I think about. And of course, as a Christian, as a follower of Christ, that makes sense to me, because Christ did sacrifice himself for our sakes and our beauty. And this figure, a traumatized figure on the cross, is the most beautiful figure, but we can't see that on the side of human experience. So there's this paradoxical nature of beauty, and I do not think beauty is a relative term or subjective, although you can certainly talk about a subjective experience of beauty, but there's something very much about the character of God that pre-existed even a notion of beauty or even a notion of existence that we have to consider. And that is the most beautiful thing, very much something that cannot be put into a box, cannot be defined, cannot be certainly commodified and sold. It is that part of us that is essential.
You know, it seems like maybe it was, you know, decades ago, art was a natural outgrowth of religious expression, but it, feel like there may have been seasons where Christians have sort of downplayed the influence of art. I mean, is it coming back, or you know, how has it changed from, you know, the 1600s?
Right. Funny thing is, we have not ceased to be religious. Mm. We just began to worship something else rather than this God of history, and so art has always been religious, whether you call it's secular or non-Christian or whatever you label it. Ultimately, it speaks about the vacuum of what we, you know, desire not to have God's presence in our lives, or whatever we are speaking about. It's hard to get away from the transcendent spiritual when it comes to art. And so I suppose you can have an argument that 20th century art, especially modern art, as you know, is exiled from this traditional understanding of God. But when you look at it closely, artists are actually speaking into the void that the church has mostly failed to, especially in Protestant theology, that there's mystery beyond a pragmatic, propositional framework of theology. And artists are the ones that kept it alive in our culture. And so we have today many people who probably have deeply spiritual experiences watching cinema, but don't know what to call that. And the church will be the last place that they will visit. But, you know, when you're an artist, you realize that such an experience not only happens to us, but it happens to people who are looking at our artwork and you know, who are sitting next to us in theaters. And it's important that as we understand beauty and as we understand transcendence and the gospel of Jesus Christ, that these experiences, you know, the Holy Spirit doesn't have to stay within the walls of our churches, physical churches. The Holy Spirit is free to roam wherever he wants to go, and as Jesus told us to sow, and just like the wind blows in and out, and we have to, as followers of Christ, follow that. So there's a lot that we can learn from entertainment, popular arts, as well as fine arts, and this is, I think, primarily why there is such a hunger for beauty in contemporary lives.
You know, I was going to ask you, I guess, from the church, what are the arts for? What's their role? But maybe you can just give us a sense of, you know, ideally, what part could art bring back into, particularly, I guess, our Protestant churches, where we've lost the mystery some of it, haven't we?
And I would reverse that question and say, what is the gospel for? I spoke this morning at chapel and I said, you know, we have preached for mostly in 20th century, especially in Protestant churches, what I call plumbing Jesus, you know, plumber of Jesus, plumbing theology. And what I mean by that is, you know, plumbers fix things and God certainly fixes things. And we're grateful for that, that the redemptive story, the narrative, is very much at the heart of the gospel. But what is it for? you know, and where did it come from? And before that brokenness, there was creation. In the beginning, God created, and that he saw what he created was good. And that word saw is very much to a visual artist, this cue that this art that God is creating is visual, and that seeing something is to create and to think, to, you know, that there is such a thing as visual theology that existed before there was anything. So going from that to our brokenness and of course, the plumbing that needs to be fixed. But what, if we fix the plumbing, what is flowing through our plumbing? You know, the water of the Holy Spirit that is flowing through the plumbing that has been redeemed is doing something, and it is there for purpose of bringing in, ushering in this new world that God is reconciling for himself and for us. And this miraculous reality that in that process that God has invited us, fallen, broken creatures, to be redeemed and to be made into co-heirs of his new reality, the greater reality that will come to be, and that through beauty and mercy we can participate in that reality. That this is the miraculous news of the gospel. So the arts, artists, poets, filmmakers, dancers, theater, they're all speaking into this margins of reality that we don't necessarily address. Because we're so fixed on the fixing part, and artists are in Genesis, artists are in Revelation, artists are in Ezekiel, artists are these types of people who see between the margins the spirit moving, and they may not be religious. They may even call themselves atheists. They may be actively working against churches and their agendas, but when they create, there is something about that mystery that when you behold as a believer, as a follower of Christ, you begin to affirm. And this is very important that when we do, we are able to, if we can, tell the artist that this is beautiful. What you're doing matters. That what you're creating into the world is important. Because I'm a Christian, I value what God is doing through you, even though you may not be able to understand or accept that. But thank you for doing what you're doing.
Wise insight today from Emeka Fujimura, who is an artist, former presidential appointee to the National Council on the Arts. He's the founder of the International Arts Movement and the Fujimura Institute. He's director of Fuller Seminary's Brehm Center. He was on the campus of the University of Northwestern speaking today. We're honored to have him with us in the studio, and we're going to continue our conversation in a moment. Talk a little bit about maybe how do we cultivate and inspire creativity in our children and ourselves, and also want to hear Emeka's story as he spent some time living right near Ground Zero when the towers went down, and want to hear that story and more just ahead on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're honored to connect today with internationally renowned artist Makoto Fujimura, who serves as the director of Fuller Seminary's Brehm Center for Worship, Theology, and the Arts. He's also the founder of the International Arts Movement, and his books include Refractions and Culture Care, and the new one, Silence and Beauty, Hidden Faith, Born of Suffering. And Makoto, I want to talk about pragmatism. It seems a modern education and culture focus primarily on pragmatism. So how do we help inspire creativity in our children and in ourselves and break away from the pragmatism that's so prevalent in our culture?
Well, first let me say that, you know, even in pragmatic occupations today, like being a nurse or being an engineer, the field of studies in any of these areas is so vast, and practically, things are changing every day. So if you're an engineer being trained as a freshman in college today, in 4 years, you're going to graduate into a vastly different world. So what you need, actually, if you're an engineering major, is to do theater, to understand that problem solving can happen collaboratively, spontaneously, as you work to create beauty, that there are a certain knowledge that you can access through community of people who are committed to creating something together that you will not be able to otherwise access. And if you have that divergent thinking experience, that you will do far better as an engineer, as a doctor, as parents, as a carpenter, as a plumber, that, you know, all of us has to be entrepreneurial in this very challenging economy. And we are better for it if we spend at least a little time thinking about what the arts inform us, namely this practice of imagination to cultivate divergent thinking that allows for flexibility when things seem to be at standstill. Artists are the ones that can come up with new ways of looking at it. And so, you know, this is practical. Arts are practical to survival, and successful people all understand this. And so, you know, it's something that I think is, first of all, important to understand. Now, second of all, we are all born artists. Every child in kindergarten will raise their hand if you ask them, are you creative, imaginative, are you an artist? And then by the time third grade comes, somebody tells us that we're not an artist, and we believe them. And then eventually we wake up one day, maybe in our 50s, and we realize we've accomplished everything that we set to accomplish. I've been successful at everything that I've set to accomplish. And yet I don't feel like I have created anything into the world. That magic that I had as a child of being able to walk around the world with wonderment, all that magic is gone. I have everything that I need, I want, I desire. And yet I have not been able to access that most important part of reality of life, that magic of life. And that's probably when we walk into a theater or watch a movie and all of a sudden something hits us, or, you know, hear a song on the radio and we start weeping because that artist is able to articulate something that I've longed to know all my life, but I've disguised it in this service of pragmatism. There's nothing wrong with pragmatism. You know, when you go back into the early philosophers, William James and folks who saw pragmatism as a way to understand ourselves, they're talking about mystery as well as utility. So, you know, we have to realize that this is a broader conversation. As I said, you know, engineer that is taking theater classes, you know, has a vastly different level of knowledge than people who do not. So this is all very practical in that level. But at the same time, for children, it's important, right, to understand that their world both needs to be preserved and also challenged. Each person has different gifts, and so every child has a different path. You know, my wife and I, my wife is a psychotherapist, and we have three grown children, and we always said, you know, train a child to the path that he needs to go, to the or she needs to go, not the way we want them to go. And that requires a lot of listening. That requires us to watch and see what happens when our children are allowed to be themselves, and to ask difficult questions that perhaps we are afraid to ask, but they're willing to ask. And not only listen to their questions and understand their fears or understand their dreams, but to resource that as a way for us to understand the world. And my journey with my children has been really been about me learning as much as what I can teach them. And they are enormously creative creatures. And, you know, our education system, as you noted, trains them not to be.
And so we have to, as parents, protect that and nurture that. And they will have the answers ultimately, and they will create that future for themselves. We are there to support that.
Just making some notes, I think, you know, listen, watch, and ask. Those are pretty important words as Christ followers and as parents. You also talked about collaboration, spontaneity, and community. And I thought those words should probably describe the church today, the body
Absolutely.
Of Christ, right?
That's,
I mean,
Absolutely.
Could
That's
the right. church lead the way in bringing back a, I mean, becoming culture makers? Mm-hmm. And what would that look like?
Yeah. So I always say, we're anticipating and awaiting and preparing for the cosmic wedding to come. We are the bride of Christ, and he's the bridegroom. And in the ultimate consummation of the universe and multiverse, whatever you want to call it, we are going to have this cosmic wedding. Christians are cosmic wedding planners. So as wedding planners, we are thinking about, okay, so how do I best uplift the celebration, and how do I prepare for it? Well, you want to have the best musicians. You want to choreograph the best dance. You want to have the best meal. You want to have the best poetry. You want to have best theater. You want to have all of the arts of represented in a wedding. Mm-hmm. And how are we doing preparing for this cosmic wedding? You know, I ask, who are the musicians that God is going to call to be the best musicians to play at his wedding? Mm-hmm. Who are the people who are preparing for this? The graphic designers, the, you know, the plumbers, the everybody is going to be called into this this amazing dance at the end of time, amazing feast. And I don't think, for the most part, if we look back into especially 20th century Protestant history, we have not done well to cultivate the next generations of the best musicians, best artists, best filmmakers, best, you know, everything, chefs. And I think it's time is here that we began to intentionally begin generationally to raise, because this is going to take several generations of commitment to beauty, to worship, to bring together this understanding that God is so gratuitous with his gifts to us in creation, that there are useless things everywhere that is screaming beauty through the mysteries of life and creation. And we need to, as co-heirs, as creators, as makers, you know, that is submitting ourselves to this grand narrative, that we need to become that beautiful artwork of God as people of God. And so a church needs to be beautiful. Doesn't mean you have to spend millions of dollars, you know, creating beauty into the chapels. Maybe some are called to that. Maybe some are not. But I know that even in the poorest countries and the poorest villages, people who dare to create beauty, create beauty. It doesn't seem to matter how much resources, you know, that how much experience they have. Human beings are created for beauty, and we will make that. No matter if the resources are limited, so that's, you know, there's no excuse for us as a church, because we are called to be the beautiful bride of Christ.
Important insights from Meiko Fujimura, internationally recognized artist. He serves as the director of the Fuller Seminary Brehm Center for Worship Theology and the Arts. He's also the founder of the International Arts Movement. He's just released a brand new book called Silence and Beauty, Hidden Faith, Born of Suffering. It's from InterVarsity Press. We have 4 copies to give away, and we'll do that via email. If you go to the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com, you can use the email tab there and give us your contact information. We'll put you in the drawing for one of these 4 copies. It's the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com.
to be in the drawing for Silence and Beauty, and we'll hear more from Meiko Fujimura in just a moment. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We've been talking about beauty and creativity and art and mystery and the wonder of God's handiwork so abundantly evident all around us. Meiko Fujimura, who's director of Fuller Seminary's Brehm Center, is an artist, a writer, a speaker, and was a presidential appointee to the National Council of the Arts. He serves as an international advocate for the arts and has been on the University of Northwestern campus, and so we're honored to just have some time with him today in the studio. You lived for a time right in Manhattan, in fact, just a few blocks away from the Twin Towers. You were there when those towers went down. And out of that, you ended up creating kind of a new community. Talk about that.
Yeah, I wasn't intending to, but 15 years we lived in downtown Manhattan and raised our children there. And we just happened to move into three blocks from where the towers used to stand. And so 9/11 was a horrific and traumatic time for all of us. And I recount some of that in my books, Refractions, and also new book, Silence and Beauty, because through these traumas, God can speak, even though God seems silent at the time. And I retraced these steps of how God speaks those times, and especially through broken efforts and efforts that may not seem so heroic, and at times it seems the opposite, you know, how God seems to be not only be present to us, but will reveal a new vision for us, a new mission for us. So I had a lot of time thinking about this in the ground zero experience of my own life. But through Endo's book, Shusaku Endo's book, Silence, I've been thinking about Japanese history and the traumas of their history, including 17th century history, but also 20th century history of devastation and trauma. So I've been following those trails as part of my journey.
Silence and Beauty, Hidden Faith, Born of Suffering. It's new out from InterVarsity Press. You did end up moving into the country after years in the city. I'm just curious to know how you're liking farm life, or how has that changed or reframed the artwork that you're doing now?
Yeah, everything affects your art. If you're an artist, you know where you live, what's happening to you. We're like this transparent reality that you can look through and see what's exactly what's happening. And part of my art is to be honest with my journey and high and low. And you will see that reflected in my art throughout in my writings. And it's been wonderful to be out in Princeton Farmstead that we were so fortunate to be part of. And the first time in my life that I had the pleasure of gardening and thinking about the soil and raising chickens. And it's all come about because my wife, who's a psychotherapist, realized that I was burning out and being in front lines of battle, whether it be in the church or whether it be restoration of downtown, or being in front lines as an artist has its limits. And I can't just dwell stoically trying to survive when there were signs of issues that I wasn't even aware of. But when I moved to this beautiful farmland, I realized that so much of my life has to be tended to, and the soil has to rest a little bit. So I began to think about, you know, this metaphor of agrarian language into what I do as an artist. And a lot of what I call culture care is came out of that. You know, culture care is a vision to change the metaphor of culture from culture wars to culture care. And I say that culture is not a war to win. It is instead an ecosystem to steward, a garden to take care of. And we need to be better at preparing the soil of culture for the next generation to plant their fruits and their seeds. And since we haven't done that in the past years, we're suffering for it. The culture is decimated with polarized, divisive language. We can no longer speak to each other. We do not do well in public discourse in terms of civility, in terms of deeper communication. So now these are things that artists are good at, but they have been in the front lines of culture wars. And so we've lost this touch of power of reconciliation that our words can bring, that our art can create, the vista for this reconciliation. And we have not been doing well to create this collaborative creativity that theater can bring. And we haven't been dancing together through our differences to speak of the future that, you know, democracy exists for diversity and pluralism to coexist. Democracy is an experiment. It's fragile. And we can't let that simply be wiped away by fears and anxiety for the future, because from the get-go, it was not assumed to be safe or, you know, something that is permanent. It's something that all of us has to speak into. And so I offer culture care as a way to speak into the current crisis in culture. And I found that just by changing the metaphor, you end up talking about different things.
Mako, just curious, kind of on a personal level, is there a favorite material that you like to work with, or has that changed over the year? I mean, you've done painting, you know, a number of different things.
Right. Well, I have always worked with 17th century Japanese materials as a base, at least a starting point. Even in my writings, I start out of my studio mixing minerals and pulverized minerals, malachite, azurite, beautiful prismatic materials, colors that come out of, but very limited materials that Japanese have cultivated and refined, working with natural brushes and paper and silk. And I work with silk makers who raise silkworms just to make this particular type of silk. And so I stick to that because I think part of the message of Japanese beauty is that it is an ecosystem that connected, you know, people that are committed to creating something beautiful together. And that's going away. That's disappearing. That's an endangered species of culture. So I want to help what I can do to preserve that and to help even grow that. So this is what I stick to, because I realize that what I do is very much an honor. Not many people get to spend full time creating things, but at the same time, this is what we're called to, all of us, into this studios of God's creation called the world, to make, you know, do what we can to create beauty and transcendent realities into the world. And so I want to invite people into that as well.
We only have a minute or so left. Would you maybe just say a word of encouragement to someone as you addressed? And maybe they're in their 50s or maybe older, and they've you know, they've done the work track, but felt like, you know, I've missed something. How could they you know, get that spark back again?
Yeah. So, you know, there are many examples of novelists and artists like Grandma Moses, who started quite late in life, and arts are rejuvenating. You know, they have this longitudinal study that the NEA did of people involved in choirs, you know, and they measured people in their 80s and for 10 years, they tracked them, and they thought that some will unfortunately pass away in the process. And lo and behold, people who are involved in this particular choir, they didn't lose anybody. Everybody lived those 10 years. And that's an astonishing statistic if you think about it. You know, like people involved in the arts literally kept alive by art, by beauty, by being part of a community. And so if you want one pragmatic reason for it, you know, that's the reason. But beyond that, I think if you ask any of those people who are singing, you know, why is this important to you, you'll come up with multiple answers, right, that may not relate to each other or make sense. There are stories, there are realities of what happens when we sing, and the particular experience that we have are all going to be different. So the answer to your question is going to be very different for each person. But I would say, you know, take that risk and carve out that place in your life, whether you're in your 50s or in your 20s, it doesn't matter. You know, I always say, you know, Emily Dickinson had a 17.5-inch cherry wood square desk in her room in Amherst, and that's all she had, and a little lamp. She woke up 3 a.m. every morning to write poems until 5 so she can take care of her mother and bake after that. She cultivated gardens that Frederick Olmsted came and saw, not knowing that it was Emily Dickinson that was cultivating it. You know, and invisibly, these people exist in the world, and no one needs to know, right? We don't have to have a purpose for that other than the intrinsic reason of existing and doing what we're called to do. So the question I ask everybody is, do you have that desk? Do you have that 17.5-inch desk that is dedicated to your art? You know, don't put bills on it. You know, just have that desk and maybe carve out a time every Saturday morning where you make yourself sit in front of it to sketch, to write that last stanza of your poem, to make that next paragraph of your novel, maybe dream about your next business, maybe think about how you might serve your church. All these things, you know, an act of creativity and making that all of us are called to, and create beauty in that reality. Make sure that you give yourself the luxury of wasting time, because we will find that at the end of our lives, that when we wasted time with our children, when we wasted time with each other, when we wasted time for ourselves, that we will remember those times perhaps more than what we built in our resume, what we accomplished in our lives. It's those conversations, it's those intangible realities, it's the, you know, the invisible lines of threads that we begin to see unravel in front of us, that in the grace, you know, threads that are weaving our lives. And, you know, really, that may be the only thing we remember at the end of our lives. So, you know, start in the best way we can, in the most practical manner, but in the ways that are necessary for us, begin that journey.
Powerful conversation. And we're all called into the studio of God's creation. Meiko Fujimura joining us today. He's the director of Fuller Seminary's Brehm Center. He's an artist, a presidential appointee to the National Council on the Arts, founder of the International Arts Movement and the Fujimura Institute. And we're honored to have him in the studio today. Meiko, thank you so much for what you do. You've been listening to Connecting Faith.